This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dinosaurs have thundered across the silver screen since the early age of cinema. And in those films, they have also cavorted with humans, emerged unscathed from glaciers, and spewed venom and fire. All imaginative and all wildly inaccurate portrayals of the science behind these creatures. The North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh is hosting a conversation next week between movie experts and paleontologists, and they will consider when films have gotten the science right or wrong, and why we are forever drawn to reimagining these prehistoric reptiles. Marcia Gordon is one of the people on that panel. She is film studies professor at North Carolina State University and co-star of Movies on the Radio. Welcome back, Marcia.
Hi, Frank.
And Elena Schrader is here as well, a paleontologist, postdoctoral researcher at North Carolina State. Elena, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
And Mary Schweitzer is a paleontologist and professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at NC State. Hello, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I want to start by asking about, start with Marcia here, the film science. The earliest examples of dinosaurs on film, they show up very early in the.
Yeah, I mean, not surprisingly, given the fact that there were not dinosaurs roaming the Earth after film was created in the 1890s, the earliest examples of dinosaurs on film were animated. So it's really cool that this technology that allowed film to break from reality could be used to imagine things that could not be filmed. So what you get are a couple different styles of representing dinosaurs. And so one early example is from 1914, and it's a film called Gertie the Dinosaur that was done by a very famous animator named Winsor McCay. And this is a film, it's a short film, but it combines live action with animation, and it's Winsor McCay trying to win a bet that he can bring these dinosaur bones in a museum back to life. And so he does that by hand-drawing, you know, frame by frame, as it were, these drawings with a slight change between them, and then they get filmed and they bring this adorable, cute dinosaur to life that he can control, and it's the kind of very the friendly dinosaur.
And then there's the film The Lost World in 1925, right?
Yeah, so I really like this film in terms of the conversation that we're having today about dinosaurs and the movies. This is about finding a world of dinosaurs in South America, a lost world. And so this is imagining that in the 1920s, human beings and dinosaurs coexist. And this is the kind of dinosaurs as monsters scenario. So unlike Gertie, which, you know, Gertie's super cute. You can find Gertie online and watch this. But these are really scary claymation dinosaurs. So the way that they were filmed were literally a clay figure moving a little bit at a time and then and photographed in single shots and then reanimated. But they're terrifying. They kill each other. But they really were a way for, again, these filmmakers to imagine how human beings can interact with dinosaurs in this imaginative space. And in fact, Encyclopedia Britannica Films in the 1940s took out all of the dinosaur moments of this film and used it as a classroom film to teach students about dinosaurs, because this is high-end special effects, you know, kind of imagining what dinosaurs look like and how they act.
Therein lays some of the problem, though, Elena, in that that's really how we thought. Now we believe dinosaurs must have moved like that, right? Because the first time and often we see them in this kind of, you know, sort of herky-jerky motion. What do we know from the paleontology about the movement of dinosaurs?
So we know that a lot of the ways that dinosaurs moved are not, especially not in a lot of those early movies, is not representative. One of the things that was thought about a lot of the sauropod dinosaurs, which are the ones that have the long necks and long tails and walk on four legs, a lot of early thought was that they lived in swamps to support their weight. And one of the things that actually, with the advent of more advanced ways of looking at bones, that we came to realize was that, no, they actually do stand on land without having to support their necks with the water or anything like that, which is one of the great things about Jurassic Park, for example, is being able to bring to life this representation of what is closer to what we think dinosaurs move like. The part of the movie where the sauropod rears on its hind legs, that was actually the result of some study that some paleontologists did with elephants to see if elephants could rear and therefore transitively see if the biomechanics would work out for sauropods. So even that moment in the movie was a representation of scientific study that was done to see if it was possible.
And do the joints, so the joints must suggest that they could actually kind of do that way, not only move that way, but then support the weight even momentarily.
Right.
Yeah. Oddly enough, Marcia, John Wayne really did walk that way. That's a, just want to point that out. Mary, the 1925, you talk about Lost World, and it seems to me that this was one of the ways we wanted to imagine dinosaurs. That is, that they're still with us somewhere, that there's some place on this earth that we haven't discovered, and they haven't gone extinct, right? This is part of our imagination.
I hold out hope.
And what do you? What about the science of that? I mean, is there anything? Is that impossible? Could they still be here?
Well, as a scientist, of course, you can't say anything is impossible or will never happen. But we have absolutely no data to support the fact that dinosaurs, non-avian dinosaurs, are still around and walking around in the jungles. Now, if we had hard data, it would be very intriguing, and you'd have a host of paleontologists descending on the Nile River, wherever this would be. But there is no believable evidence that dinosaurs are still walking around somewhere.
And I think it's also kind of interesting in a scenario like The Lost World, and this I think taps into our human fantasies about dinosaurs, is that film ends with them bringing a brontosaurus back to London. And what happens? Brontosaurus gets loose and goes running through London. And at the end of the film, even back in 25, people, this brontosaurus is swimming off. So there could be the sequel waiting around the corner. So I think we have this fascination that, wow, maybe we just have to find a portal to another time or dimension or a place that people, meaning Western people, haven't discovered, and maybe they'll just be there, and then we can, you know, incorporate them into our universes.
Well, and again, as you say, and film loves to do this, to show things that can't be seen otherwise. So future dramas and the idea of going to the moon and all of that,
yes,
things we can't imagine actually or can't actually see. And then, of course, that world that has been lost to us forever. What about the science, though, in terms of we not quite sure why the last dinosaur left the planet? There's lots of theories out there. But is there anything about the atmosphere today and the world in which we live today that would make it impossible, knowing what we know about them?
Well, one thing that I would like to say that your viewers might not be aware of is that birds are dinosaurs, a fact that doesn't often come up in movies. So the turkey that you eat at your Thanksgiving dinner is, in fact, a dinosaur. So in a certain sense, dinosaurs are still with us, just avian dinosaurs are. In terms of why dinosaurs at large, non-avian dinosaurs that we want to reimagine coming back when extinct, particularly, we know, we have very solid evidence that it was an asteroid impact that contributed to that greatly, was the main reason for that. So
lots of dust in the air, affected plant life. They need lots and lots of plants. And goodbye.
But even just the impact itself probably would have caused lots of worldwide fires, really. Like, it would have been, the planet would have been very bad for.
And I think that's part of our fascination is with the idea of extinction. And then in the world of film, even if you think about these early films, that then these creatures can be reanimated and brought to life through the magic of film. So I think there's always that interplay between the kind of the dead and resurrection that's a play in all of these stories.
That's still a really big hope. I mean, there's a group of people that work actively to resurrect extinct species, and they're not working on something as old as the dinosaurs yet. But that's a very active area of research, and it's not, I guess you could say, for recently extinct animals like the dodo, for example. It might not be impossible. But when you think about resurrecting a dinosaur, you can ask questions like, what exactly does that mean? A living, breathing dinosaur? How about if we resurrect the dinosaur trait? Can we make a chicken with teeth? And those are doable things, theoretically, anyway.
But this brings us to the genetics and the genetic study of dinosaurs, what you're looking for and what you're able to determine by looking at a bone or even soft tissue. How much of genetic technology do you bring now to the study of dinosaur bones? I'll start with you, Mary.
Well, what we have found in the course of the last 12 to 15 years, things that we never thought we would find in association with dinosaur bones. So the classic example of dinosaurs die, they're buried in the right place, all their organics rot away, and they're filled with mineral, and the bone slowly turns to stone. We've known all along that that doesn't explain some of the stuff that we've seen in the rock record, but we never expected to see anything originally organic, any original proteins or DNA. But when we began to pull soft, flexible, transparent blood vessels and cells out of dinosaur bone, it became, well, if these things are preserved in three dimensions, what else could they be? And you build a case by looking at data and accumulating data. And indeed, all of the data that we have says these things were produced by the once living dinosaurs. So the question becomes, now what can we do with it? And so for me, my questions don't deal with, and Alina as well, most of the stuff that we do doesn't deal with, are we going to bring back a dinosaur? But it's more, for me, the questions that drive me are, first of all, what made them so successful? Because dinosaurs were the dominant terrestrial organism on the planet for 150 million years, and we have not been around that long.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that, just as an aside, part of the reason dinosaurs are so fascinating is because if such a massively successful, widespread, long-lived organism like a dinosaur can go extinct, what does that mean for us?
Yeah, who's not quite as adept as we've seen once they get control of the planet. And also, they're preposterous animals. I mean, in terms of the amount, well, I mean, if you think about the amount of food I think they need, I could be misguided about that, but anything that big has got to eat a lot, and they managed to do it for millions of years.
One of the things about dinosaurs that I think make them so fascinating is that there's still a lot of aspects of some of their biology that we have no clue how it operated, because there just aren't any living analogs to compare against to understand this process. And, you know, I think it's really telling that, as Mary said, a lot of what we deal with is not necessarily trying to bring back dinosaurs as much as understand them better, get that better picture of what dinosaurs would be in our imagination. But I think it's really telling that when we talk with the public a lot, the first question we almost always get asked is, when are we going to be able to clone a dinosaur? Because I think one of the things is that for a lot of us, it's not enough to know. We want to experience. And I think that's one of the things that movies really bring. Depiction of dinosaurs make us feel like we're experiencing more than just knowing.
You've also talked about some of the things we've learned about what we're looking for, just in terms of understanding what happens, the change that takes place in any organism that has died, and then the change in fossilization. Those are two different processes, and something that you need to know something about before you can make any judgment, right?
Yes, yes, that's very true. We look a lot at what happens to modern animals as they die and then become disarticulated and buried to know anything about what might have happened in the past, because all we have left is the end product.
And I mean, I think this is the speculative, whether it's scientific reason speculation or not. I mean, when I think even about that 1920s film, The Lost World, that I talked about earlier, they talk about, well, this is a brontosaurus. Don't worry about it. It only eats leaves. And this is an allosaurus, which is how they refer to it. And it's a meat eater. Watch out for that. So there's, even in the most fictional, non-scientific films, that there is this process of using at least popular versions of science to create your imagination.
And, of course, the most recent franchise, Jurassic Park, as a franchise, has kind of changed everything, at least in terms of the way it moved and moving forward the technology of movie making, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the first Jurassic Park comes out in 1993. This is the Steven Spielberg-directed film based on the Michael Crichton novel. And the premise is wonderful. I mean, right, it's about this rich mogul type who goes about cloning dinosaurs for this island theme park, which now seems even more... Like, if I read this headline tomorrow, I probably wouldn't bat an eye. I'd go, well, of course this is happening, but science fiction is always like this. It's always predictive, right? So, of course, what happens is they run amok, right? And it's all about what goes wrong when we start messing with this kind of technology, especially now for the service of entertainment.
Also, gender has played an important role in our understanding of paleontology, and it had been, Mary, I'll start with you, this had been a male-dominated field, perhaps still is, right?
Absolutely. I think it is a male-dominated field still, although it certainly has changed. I think my first meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology that I attended as a graduate student, I think maybe there were 10 women there. And the other thing that's changed, not only in addition to about 50% women now, but also traditionally dinosaur sciences have been in the geological sciences. And as women become more and more dominant in the field, so do biologists. So I don't know whether that's correlated or not, but we're definitely taking a more biological look at these ancient animals.
Well, in Jurassic Park, Ellie Slatter certainly put the guy straight in this scene, as played by Laura Dern.
Is this West Indian lilac?
Yes. We know they're toxic, but the animals don't eat them.
You sure?
Pretty sure.
There's only one way to be positive. I'd have to see the dinosaurs dropping.
Dino. Dropping? That is one big pile of shit.
You're right. There's no trace of lilac berries. It's so odd, though. All right. So she's suffering from melia toxicity. Every 6 weeks. Rats. Nada.
She's,
Every 6 weeks.
Tenacious.
You have no idea.
You will remember to wash your hands before you eat anything.
Ellie Sattler up to her elbows in paleontology in the movie Jurassic Park. Elena, you know what? Just the science of that alone. I mean, I get, oh, that's nice. She's gonna figure the guys are standing back. She says, mm-hmm. How am I going to do this? Now, can you really just sort of feel your way through the diet of a dinosaur? Or don't you have to go into a lab somewhere?
Well, we usually encounter it fossilized.
There you go.
So we can't reach in.
Yeah, yeah. That's that.
I loved this scene and a lot of scenes with her character in the movie. Jurassic Park came out when I was 9. And even now, we know now, especially from a lot of research, that inspiring groups to get involved in science is really influenced by representation of who you see represented on the screen. And Ellie was such a great character for me at 9 years old to see her setting these guys straight, but not necessarily in a domineering way. She knew what she was doing, and she was more than happy to share her knowledge in a, you know, a confident way. And
well, I know that you're setting us straight in a lot of things about dinosaurs. They didn't live with humans. A lot of them had feathers. Many of them didn't have teeth.
They might
have
had
beaks.
We still eat them.
We still eat them. But this has to be true, right? This is Dino on the Flintstones. This has to be right. That is the sound that dinosaurs made, right? That's pretty much what we know about how they spoke.
For most dinosaurs, we don't have any evidence of what sound they made, except there are a couple.
So it could be. That's exactly what they might sound like.
Not that one. No, that one.
How about the boing? Did they have that when they ran? Talk more about – so this is kind of sad. I do not want to be disabused of this. So you can have your science if you want.
Hold your ears.
Climate change I accept, but the Dino didn't make that sound. You've gone too far. Feathers, this is kind of interesting because the more – you know, I had known for maybe 10 or so years that birds were dinosaurs and that more reptiles than we thought or more dinosaurs than we thought. But it seems, Mary, let me ask you this, that perhaps a lot of dinosaurs had feathers. That goes way back farther than we thought.
It seems to be the case. At least there's some tentative data to suggest that the ancestor of both Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus rex maybe had feathers, and those are the two lineages of dinosaurs. But based just upon relationships and physiology and other evidence like that, we had predicted that dinosaurs would have feathers, non-avian dinosaurs. But it was only in 1995 that the first one was actually found with feathers. And I got to tell you, I was at the meeting when that little guy showed up, and it was a tiny little critter about maybe this big on a slab. And you could have heard a pin drop everywhere that thing went, because it was the first direct evidence that dinosaurs had an insulatory covering. And, of course, if you have insulation, you don't have it unless you need it, which means direct evidence that this guy was probably warm-blooded.
Getting to warm-blooded, a great adaptive feature that brought us to the brink of destruction, in fact. Mm. But that's another show.
That's totally another show. But pterodactyls, when you see them in the movies, do they ever endow them with feathers even though they fly?
Pterodactyls are not dinosaurs.
Yes, they're not dinosaurs.
Oh, that's why.
Illusion today.
But why are they always in dinosaur movies? Everyone loves a pterodactyl.
See, and that's one of the things about movies that is kind of prevalent. One of the mistakes that people get wrong is that a lot of things they depict were ancient reptiles related to dinosaurs. Pterodactyls are actually pterosaurs, are pretty closely related, but they are not dinosaurs.
It ain't over.
They paid me to
the
say
show
this.
This part of the show is over, but the conversation continues. I have pterodactyls at Thanksgiving. Marcia Gordon is a film studies professor at North Carolina State. Elena Schrader is a paleontologist and postdoctoral researcher at North Carolina State. And Mary Schweitzer is also a paleontologist and a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having
Thanks
us.
For having us.
So you can catch them all. Movies, Science in the Movies, next Thursday, September 7th, 7 o'clock, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. We've got that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, a dystopian novel about the salt line. Stay tuned.